Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. With today's smartphone technology, it seems as if there's an app for almost everything. And now, events in Ferguson have inspired an app designed to help people of different backgrounds learn more about each other. More on that in a couple of moments. But first, how well do you remember the names of our presidents? Could you list them all in the order in which they served? A Washington University professor who is a memory expert has been asking students to do just that for some four decades now. He's compiled his findings in a study released late last month, co-authored by one of his graduate students. Both are with me in studio. I welcome Roddy Roediger, professor of psychology at Washington University. Andy DeSoto is his PhD student. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Hi, good afternoon.
Roddy, let me start with you and ask you just to give me a general overview of this study. What's it all about? What are you trying to do?
Okay. Many years ago, I started collecting data on how well college students could remember the U.S. presidents. And at that time, we were looking at patterns of the order in which they could do it. And we followed up this experiment over the decades. We have other data from the early 1990s. And then Andy DeSoto, who's here with us, will be getting his PhD in just a few months. He helped with the latest instantiation. We asked Washington University students to also recall the presidents. And so it occurred to us, once we had all these data, they're very regular, they're very pretty, they're very orderly. But we could also look at how presidents are forgotten over time, in fact, over four decades. So to give you an example, a president like Lyndon Johnson or Gerald Ford, everyone knew them in 1973 and 1974 when I began this study. But let's take the case of Johnson, who was so influential in so many ways. In 1991, when we asked college students to think of all the presidents they could in 5 minutes, 71% got Johnson, so he dropped about 29% in that time. And then when Andy repeated the experiment in 2009, only 42% of Washington University students could think of Johnson when given 5 minutes. So you see he's dropped from almost perfect recall or perfect memory of at least college students down to less than half of them being able to think of his name. It seems amazing to someone my age for whom Johnson was in many ways a hero. He passed the Civil Rights Act. He did many other things. He also, unfortunately, got us more deeply into the war in Vietnam. But it's still amazing to me that he's not better remembered today.
Well, maybe not remembered in terms of where he stood in the sequence of presidents. I'm guessing at this. But does that mean that people have forgotten him entirely and don't recall the Civil Rights Act?
Well, they might if you prompted them and gave them a cue. Remembering him in order, actually, people are down to only, in 2009, only 20% could place him in the right place. Only 42% thought of him at all. So now if we gave them a test and said, okay, Lyndon Johnson, tell us some things he did as president, just assert that he was president. Maybe they could, but I'd be surprised. It would be like us trying to remember, what did Chester Arthur do when he was president?
I hope you're not asking.
What did Coolidge do? What did Zachary Taylor do? So at one point, those things were perfectly well known to every American, and now most of us would struggle, if we're not historians or history buffs, to come up with answers for those early presidents.
Andy DeSoto, let me ask you, why is this important? Why is this whole study over the years important, do you think?
I think it's important because the presidents, the leaders of the country are, I think, one of the most important, valuable things that Americans can know about. It's useful to know about the presidents because what they did and their actions are so tied to the history of the country, for example. And, for example, for me, it helps me to know about the presidents because it helps me – it gives me a structure to think about events in American history and sort of how we got here and where we've been.
I would guess that we probably could match the events in history a lot better than we could with the people who were president at the time.
I think so, too. And I think there's something about the narrative structure that presidents – thinking about the presidents allows that I think really helps make things like that memorable.
If I asked you to do the list right now, could you do it from Washington through Obama?
Oh, my gosh. I'm pretty bad. I've been working on this research for a while now, and I still – it's something that is still on my to-do list to do.
Roddy, how about you?
No, I couldn't. At one point I did know all the presidents. I could relearn them. There is a song now that a lot of kids learn to that have the presidents in order. So my 11-year-old nephew, Alistair McDermott, can name the presidents in order because he knows the song and he sings it. But I don't. He can also name the states, all the states, too, because there's a similar song. But when I was growing up, either I wasn't exposed to it or it hadn't been invented yet. So.
Well, you're not alone, and obviously your study has shown that most people fall into this category. We went to several of our staff members to ask them to do exactly what you've been doing with your test. So we asked Wayne Pratt, Shula Newman, and Madeline Pater to do exactly what you're requesting. Name the presidents. Here's what we got.
Obama.
Bush.
Clinton.
Bush.
George W. Bush. Clinton. George H. Bush. Who came before that?
Reagan.
Carter.
Ford.
Nixon. Nope, Ford.
Nixon.
Then Nixon.
LBJ.
Then LBJ.
Kennedy.
Kennedy. Oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed. I don't know. This is where I'll get into trouble.
That's about as far as I go.
Was it Reagan or Carter?
Eisenhower?
Reagan, then Carter, then.
It's like Eisenhower.
Who came before that? Nixon?
FDR?
No, I'm really bad at presidents.
Hoover? Before Hoover.
I give up.
I don't know if I get them in order.
Now, I want to point out that these are three very bright people, very professional people, but very typical, apparently, Roddy.
Yes, they are. And it's interesting. They're here in Missouri, and the person they were trying to get before Eisenhower was, of course, Harry Truman, our own Missouri president, who was tremendously important, I think, in ending World War II. So it just shows how quickly these things vanish. We say in our paper that we think 50 to 100 years is probably about the lifetime of most presidents, unless something really, really important happened in their regime or they were one of the early presidents. So, for example, Abraham Lincoln, most people get him, not everybody, but most people get him because, of course, of his being instrumental in the Civil War and in ending slavery. So that's one exception. But the middle presidents are very hard. Only about 20% of Americans, or at least college students, who probably are among the best at doing this, can remember the middle presidents, except for Lincoln and people right around him.
Would you anticipate that people older than college students would do less well?
Well, what we've done that. We looked in a 2009 study that maybe I'll let Andy talk about because he did it. There's a product called Mechanical Turk Amazon produces, and people of all ages get on. They do experiments for credit, which is turned into Amazon dollars. Andy, why don't you describe this study?
Sure. So this is a study that we actually conducted in 2014, Roddy. And what we did is we programmed an experiment that we put online, and we had people participate in the study for a small amount of money. And we essentially did a digital analog of something that we had collected in the laboratory using a pen and paper. We said, name as many presidents as you can in 5 minutes and put them in the correct position if you're able to do that. And we asked people their age. So what we're able to do is, at the end of the day, we divided the data into three generations worth of people. We took a look at what we called millennials, which were people roughly from the age of 18 to 29. We looked at people who we called Generation X from 30 to 49, and we looked at people that we classified as baby boomers from 50 to 69. And what we were able to do was compare the rates of recall of these presidents among those groups. So to answer your question from earlier, you asked how good I would be at conducting this, participating in the study myself.
Bad.
Or how bad is more accurate in this case. One reassurance that I have is that, well, if you ask me again in about 40 years or so, we do see that those who are older who participate in our experiments are able to generally remember the presidents who served in office during their lifetimes.
What about those other groups, though, the millennials and the others? Do you have figures with regard to how well they did as a group?
Yes, we do. And in general, let me just look over my numbers right here. But
you can't remember them?
You'd think I'd be able to. But it is the case that because we asked for these data at the same point in time in 2014, really, for the most part, everybody showed very similar patterns of performance, believe it or not. We do see small bumps here or there for particular presidents who were in office when one particular group was alive but the others weren't. But in general, people seem to do pretty similarly.
Roddy, okay, you've got this information you've been compiling for so many years now. How do you apply what you've learned? Where does it go from here?
Well, I think you raised the important question. One thing we were able to do that nobody's been able to do before in this study is to plot an actual forgetting curve for different presidents. So we can ask, if you think of college students as having a pretty good representation of what is the collective memory of the country at that time, which we do, we don't find too much differences when we test older people, then what you can do is to say, how fast do events fade from popular memory? So right now we might think, well, everybody will always remember Obama, the first black president. Everybody will remember George W. Bush for his activities as president. But in fact, what we find is probably in 50 to 100 years, unless something really spectacular happens, the person will probably drop down to being where Chester Arthur or Millard Fillmore are today, namely remembered at some level and certainly by historians, but not in the popular consciousness of the country. And we were actually able for six presidents to plot forgetting curves, and we show that Johnson and Ford are being rapidly forgotten, relatively speaking. We predict they by about 2050, 2060, they will have dropped out of collective memory, whereas others like Kennedy and Nixon are being remembered much better. Their forgetting curves are much more shallow. Kennedy, perhaps because his brothers and other family members who have continued in politics, they keep his name alive. And, of course, he was young. He was charismatic. Being assassinated doesn't necessarily lead you to being remembered. James Garfield was assassinated. William McKinley was assassinated. Neither of them are particularly well remembered today. So we're actually able to plot a forgetting rate of collective memory. And if I could follow up with that, if you don't mind, one of the things people ask me is, well, you know, we say 9/11, we'll never forget 9/11. Remember the Alamo. Some people thought we'd never forget the Alamo. Remember the Maine, the ship that was sunk to begin the Spanish-American War. And actually, we do forget these things. I mean, it's not that they're totally gone, but if you ask people on the street, they probably wouldn't be able to tell you about the Maine, even though that was a rallying cry for many years. And just to give you an example of how I think this is important, just on Monday, of course, was December 7th, the day that
Pearl Harbor
was bombed. And all the media that I saw, TV shows, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, New York Times, other media I look at, all had stories on it. They all had pictures of the men in their 90s who still survive. So you can say, well, that's been 73 years, so that's survived. How much longer will that be once those men die? Will we still be having stories in 50 more years? So just to give you another example, 200 years ago was a very important set of events that I've been tracking all year. 200 years ago, we were fighting the War of 1812. In August, Washington was captured and burned. The Capitol was burned. The White House was burned. I saw nothing in the media about these events, even though 200 years ago, I'm sure nobody thought these events would ever be remembered as long as America was here, never be forgotten, rather, as long as America was here. But in 200 years, we're not paying attention to them.
But, of course, we have pictures of the more recent events, Pearl Harbor and the Kennedy assassination and
we
things
do.
That are and 9/11, which are etched in much of the collective memory.
Yes. No, that could be. It could be that when photography came in and now with so many other media, that is helping preserve things. World War One, of course, it began 100 years ago. It's received some attention in the media, but I have a feeling if you ask most people, they couldn't tell you much about World War One, even though it's only 100 years old, even though it was a huge event, the war to end all wars, as it was called at the time.
I've got to take a break now. You've just been listening to Roddy Roediger, professor of psychology at Washington University. He's with me in studio, as is Andy DeSoto, a PhD student at WashU. They've been involved in a test and analyzing collective memory and how well people remember our presidents, not only their names and who they were, but when they were and their sequence in the presidential cycle. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get into it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. Back with our guests in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on memory, collective memory, and we're focusing on how well people remember the presidents of the United States. How many of them are there? 43, 44, something like 44. That? 44. Thank you. Roddy Roediger from Washington University is with us, as is one of his PhD students, Andy DeSoto. That conversation continues in a moment, but first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri is preparing for its final execution of 2014. Paul Goodwin is scheduled to die by lethal injection at 1 minute past midnight tonight for killing a 63-year-old St. Louis County woman with a hammer in 1998. He would be the 10th person put to death in Missouri this year. The federal spy agency that plans to relocate its South St. Louis headquarters will host the first in a series of public meetings later today near its potential new home. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency employs 3,000 workers at its current site near the Anheuser-Busch Brewery. The federal agency has narrowed its relocation options to sites in Fenton, South St. Louis County, North St. Louis City, and St. Clair County, Illinois, near Scott Air Force Base. And the last Ferguson City Council meeting since the grand jury decision in the Michael Brown shooting case will be held tonight. Council members will hear presentations from the Ferguson Youth Initiative Summit and the Missouri Commission on Human Rights. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to Professor Roddy Roediger and Andy DeSoto, a PhD student at WashU. Andy, let me turn to you with regard to collective memory. That's come up in our discussion here on a couple of occasions. Why is collective memory something that is important and should be studied?
I think it's important because, for one, it really ties together so many academic disciplines. In some of the reading and investigations I've done in collective memory, it really is a topic that pulls in historians, it pulls in people who study psychology like us, people interested in different cultures, things like that. And I think that collective memory is an interesting area of study because it allows us to sort of put our heads together in an interdisciplinary sense and address important questions, I think.
Roddy, what is the psychological component to this?
Well, in collective memory, we think of memory, or many psychologists do, as an individual activity. It's what is in my brain and what I can bring out about the past. A collective memory has to do with how we as a people, and a people could be a family, it could be a university, it could be a city. So St. Louis kind of has collective memories of the Cardinals, for example, or the Rams of 1999. People who lived there then have these as kind of touch points. And so it gives us collective memory has to do with a sense of identity of a nation. A lot of people study collective memories of nations, Russia, the U.S., what are the other countries we have. So 9/11 means something totally different to Americans than to people living around the world. It was a real something we remember collectively and at least for a brief time gave us a sense of unity and had us rally together. The study of collective memory is kind of remembered history. There's historians try to look objectively at what happened, but people use memory for their own purposes. It provides us with our sense of identity. So we in the U.S., we have certainly people study collective memory in the U.S., and we have things that we don't like to talk about that much. In the U.S., it would be, say, how the Native Americans, the American Indians, as they're called, were treated by Europeans when they settled the country. There are just so many horror stories there. Another story we don't like to talk about much is the slavery story, because it also now, looking back, reflects badly on us. And it's taken a long time to have museums for slavery or things like that. You look at what Germany did after World War II, their collective memory. I think it's fascinating to see the differences between Germany and Japan, how they try to remember World War II. Germany has basically been castigating itself ever since World War II for the 12 years of Nazi rule there, whereas in Japan, there hasn't been the same level of self-investigation, and now the current premier is actually promoting some Japanese nationalism at sites of World War II in Japan. And so it's fascinating for me to look around the world at how people remember their past in different nations and how we do it also in the U.S. So I think it does have important ramifications for the future.
Andy, I'll put this to you and then go back to the professor with the same question. Could we conclude then that there could be something we might call a collective amnesia? That is, people who want to forget the Nazi era and want to forget slavery and want to, you know, to at least as much as possible.
It's certainly possible there could be something like that. What Roddy makes me think of is an interesting direction this type of research could go in the future, is sort of considering how we might attempt to have particular events or people remembered longer, or how we might sort of contribute or bring about this collective amnesia. It certainly is the case that we see, like we've talked about before, forgetting for some events at a steeper rate than others. But I don't know. It's a very good question.
Well, what do you think, Roddy?
I think it is important. I think we have had collective amnesia. I grew up in the South in the 1950s and early 60s, and history books there didn't talk much about slavery. It was mentioned, but it really didn't get into the depth that you would today. I think, just from my knowledge of how textbooks were created today, I think we are doing a better job of treating Native Americans and also the whole history, the sad history of slavery, in our textbooks today than we did when I was growing up. So I would say when I was growing up, there was much, I don't know if you want to call it amnesia. I'm sure historians knew it. But whether it was being communicated to school children about, say, the Wounded Knee Massacre for Indians, for the Nat Turner slave revolt for slaves, I don't remember any of that in my textbooks growing up.
A collective amnesia or selective amnesia might be a better way to put that. You know, one of the things that comes to my mind, and because, Andy, you're younger, I'll start with you on this, is, you know, looking at what we want to remember, try to remember, need to remember, or want to learn more about, we have such wonderful resources today. We've got Google, we've got Wikipedia, we've got other of the new media, if you will, opportunities to learn about the things we may have forgotten. How is that playing into all of this, or is it?
Well, I think that in many cases, the availability of that information isn't enough. And I think that if there's an event that we want to keep in our minds, that we want to have maintained in our collective memory, I think it may take an effort on our parts to ensure that those things are remembered. And that might mean all of us going home today and Googling a particular president like Chester A. Arthur, who we didn't know very much about before, most likely. So I think that the tools really do provide great opportunities, but I think we still have to choose to use them.
Roddy, I did a survey years ago of high school seniors in the metropolitan area. One of the findings was that very few of them knew the significance of the date 1492. I think we all probably know what that is all about. And I went to the superintendent of schools in St. Louis and said, "Does this bother you that in the context of history that the students didn't know this?" He said, "It's not important for them to know it. What is important for them is to know where to go to find out." What do you think of that?
Well, I keep hearing that, and I certainly you do need to know where to go to find out. But I think having knowledge is also quite good. And there's a book that Peter Brown, Mark McDaniel, and I wrote this year called Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. And we try to make the point in the book that for many occupations in your life, if you're a neurosurgeon and you're operating with somebody, you don't have the luxury of stopping and say, oh, I better Google how to do this next part. You simply have to know it. You have to have learned it. It has to be part of you. Same thing with me. And sometimes I do say when I'm lecturing college students, well, they'll ask me a question. I'll say, well, I'm going to have to find out about that. I don't know. But obviously the reason I'm up there in front of them is I'm supposed to know more than they do, and I can't say I'm going to Google everything you ask me. So I think having a firm foundation of knowledge, especially in your chosen topic, is critically important. And I think the same thing is true with history, that you know, the famous Santayana dictum of those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it, that we really need to know our history in this country and to understand how we got to where we are today.
I'm going to take a quick phone call. Our time is beginning to get away, but I want to bring in Jim to give him a chance to get into the discussion. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you so much, Don, for taking my call. I'm calling because of current events, which I think we need to make sure we remember or recognize as happening right now, along with the past. For example, slavery is and human trafficking is rampant in certain parts of the world. And I'm amazed at the number of deaths occurring where we have the Boston, you know, death of in the marathon. And it's all over the news for days, and yet dozens of people are dying in some of these places. We don't want to, in focusing on some of these things, lose track. I heard someone speaking about the recent incident in Ferguson, and they said, you know, we get the Middle East, it's a matter of justice, but we don't get it here. Well, we don't get the Middle East. So I guess I'm just saying that along with reviving and remembering appropriately these various events from the recent and distant past, we need to have our eyes lifted up at the horizon today. And another thing, there was a post-dispatch cartoon that showed a man slouched in a chair in front of his TV, railing at the protesters on the TV screen as the Wall Street crowd was carrying him, his TV, and his other belongings off, carting them off, with oblivious to what's happening with the 1% controlling 40% of the wealth and all that kind of thing.
Jim, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt, but time is getting away. I think we have to remember, and I'll put this to you, is that current events is today and soon will be history.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Certainly the case.
Any comment to what Jim had to say, Roddy?
Well, I think he's absolutely right that we need to remember and look around at what's happening today. Of course, we need to think about how that relates to the past and how we got there. I think the events in Ferguson are going to be critical. We've actually talked about how could we – this is the beginning of a collective memory of the whole country of the events in Ferguson that have been so tragic and divisive, and how we deal with those, how can we reconcile those. It's going to be very difficult that people look to reconciliation commissions. In South Africa, they had one that has been deemed around the world very successful, although when I visit South Africa, the people I talk to seem less convinced of its success. But the idea of trying to bring both sides together and have them work through an issue. So there's certainly a memory component to that. But also the ones in Ferguson are so raw and so ongoing that it will be years before I think we survey what do we remember, what has been the lesson from Ferguson. It's just too new now to us to have formed those kinds of collective ideas.
We're going to have to say goodbye in a moment, but let me ask you and Andy, the biggest surprise that you've found in all the years that you've been doing this?
Well, I remember when Gerald Ford became president, I thought, he'll never be forgotten. He's the first man to become president who was not elected president. He was not elected vice president because both the president and the vice president had to resign. He was Speaker of the House and he became president. We'll always remember that. And guess what? We don't. He's one of the fastest being presidents who's being fastest forgotten over time. So that was a surprise to me.
And maybe not the biggest surprise, but the biggest message, and this accords with common sense too, but it's everything is forgotten, everybody. So if there's something we want to try and remember, we've got to go out of our way to make sure that happens.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's a fascinating study, and the conclusions that you've drawn from it are most important indeed. Roddy Roediger, thank you for being with us once again. Good
to
see you. And Andy, it's been a pleasure meeting you. That is Andy DeSoto, who is a PhD student at Washington University, where Roddy teaches. Coming up, we'll talk about one way to make your smartphone even smarter. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.